ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहैः ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः कथाक्षकिरणाच्यान्त नमन्मोहाब्दये नमः अनन्तानन्दकृष्णाय जगन्मङ्गलमूर्तये ॐ वेरि गुड् वेल्कम् बेक् टु आर् ट्यूस्डे Vedanta class. We continue to study Advaita Makaranda. And in our previous class, I won't return to verse 7, but it was very sophisticated and it was difficult, I admit. It was quite difficult. Fortunately, the verses that are coming are not so difficult. If you had a hard time in last week's class, it's understandable. I had a hard time trying to explain that verse as clearly as I could. Anyway, every text will have several verses like that, which stand out for being difficult. So with that difficult verse 7 behind, we continue today with verse 8. Very straightforward, you can repeat after me. Na deho nendriyam chaham. Na deho nendriyam chaham, na prano namano nadhihi, na prano namano nadhihi, mamata parirabdhatvad, mamata parirabdhatvad, akridatvaridandhiyaha, akridatvaridandhiyaha. Each of these verses are manana and nididhyasana. Manana, in the sense that they're replying to certain doubts our minds might have, certain objections. Here's the doubt this verse addresses, and that is, we experience ourselves as body, mind, senses, as physical beings of flesh and bone. And that's who we are, just in a very simple, common sense, experiential way. That's who we are. And this verse, of course, we've discussed several times in the past how our experience fools us all the time, like the experience of the sunset I've given in so many examples. Here, your experience of your own body fools you into thinking that's you. Your experience of your senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, and touch, fool you into thinking you are a biological being with these five sense organs. Your prana, life force, fools you into thinking you are a living, breathing being. Your mind and intellect fool you into thinking you are that mind, you are that intellect. These are the common conclusions we always make, and these conclusions are dismissed here immediately in the first half of the verse. End of the first line, you see the word aham, not chaham, but cha-aham. Aham, as you know, is our pronoun I. Aham, I. I am na dehaha. I am not the body. Remember, I'm breaking the sandhis, so I'll be reciting words slightly different than how you see them in print. Aham na dehaha. I am not this physical body. Aham na indriyam. Breaking the words apart. Na indriyam nendriyam. I am na indriyam. I am not my senses. Na pranaha. I am not the life force that enlivens this body. Aham na manaha. I am not the mind. Na dhiyaha. Dhi is another word for buddhi. Dhi or buddhi both mean intellect. I am none of these. Why? And here's the manana. So the objection is, I am all of these. And the response is, I am none of these. Why? The last two lines give two different reasons. Here's the first reason. Mamata parirabdhatvat. says parirabdha twat, because all of those identifications, being identified with your deha, body, indriya, senses, prana, manas, and intellect, all of these kinds of identification are parirabdha twat, because they are based on mamata. Parirabdha twat, because they originate with, I'm trying to be a little bit more literal in my translation, they all originate with mamata. Now, the mamata word used here is not our Hindi and Gujarati mamata, which is, you know, fondness or love. Here it's the Sanskrit mamata, which has a very specific meaning. Mama is the pronoun my. Mamata is literally my-ness. So even though it's a very beautiful word in Hindi, in Sanskrit, my-ness is not a... It's a problem. My-ness is possessiveness, if we have to go for an English word. Possessiveness. There is a... And possessiveness is not quite the right idea here. There is a relationship. Mamata, possessiveness, my-ness, implies a relationship between possessor and possessed. Let's look at that relationship, possessor and possessed. For example, if I say, this is my pot, it is. It is my pot. Somebody gave it to me very nicely. But when I say my pot, that means there's a relationship between me, the possessor, and pot, which is possessed. And whenever there's a relationship means two things. And it also implies there's a difference or distinction between the possessor and possessed. If I say my pot, I can't say I am a pot. Anything I possess is different and separate from me. This is my pot. It's different and separate from me. My clothes, different and separate from me. My body, different and separate from me. My sense organs, different and separate from me. My prana, life force, different and separate from me. My mind, my sadness, my happiness. I'm the possessor of happiness, the possessor of sadness. As a possessor, I'm separate. Just as I'm separate from the pot that I possess, I am separate, you are separate, from the happiness and sadness you possess. And that applies to all aspects of your mind, including your intellectual powers. These are all possessed by you. Anything possessed by you is not you. That's what that term mamata refers to. Wherever there is myness, there's a relationship of possessor and possessed. Therefore, anything you possess is not you, including your body, mind, senses, etc. What about consciousness? So often we use the expression my consciousness. Your consciousness. I use that expression frequently while teaching, and it's tricky. I use it because it helps you get a sense of immediacy with regard to the topic. And I'm kind of being fussy. I'm fussy about language. So I use the term my consciousness or your consciousness very deliberately, but really speaking, it's not your consciousness. It's not my consciousness. Let's be very clear. We've had this discussion when we studied Atma Bodha. It's an important discussion. Let's repeat it here. You do not possess consciousness. So you can't truly say my consciousness. You do not have a possessor-possessed relationship with consciousness, because anything you possess can be taken away from you, and you still exist. If you take my pot away from me, I won't cry. If you take my pot away from me, I still exist. If you take these clothes away from me, it'd be embarrassing, but I still exist. If you take my body away from me, when you're asleep, your body is taken away from you. You still exist. When you're asleep, your sense organs are taken away from you. You still exist. Prana, when you die, your prana ceases to function. Your mind ceases to function. Your intellect ceases to function. You still exist as a conscious being. Consciousness is not, So all of these things can be taken away from you and you still exist. How about consciousness? If your body can be taken away from you in sleep, dream, you still exist. Can consciousness be taken away from you, subtracted from you in some way? If it were, would your existence have any meaning whatsoever? You would cease to exist. You exist as a conscious being. You are a conscious being. The point is, consciousness isn't something you possess. Consciousness is who you are. You get it? So this verse, the first of the two reasons he gives is that body, mind, and senses are all associated with this mamata. They all originate with this myness, and therefore you have a possessor-possessed relationship with each of them. Therefore, none of them are you. You are the possessor separate from all that is possessed. And then a second reason he gives is in the last line, akridatvat idam dhyaha. Second reason, also akridatvat, very odd choice of words here. Akrida is play. So akridatvat, due to the playfulness. And that's very odd. The commentator actually kind of ignores it and just gives a very straightforward meaning. If you need to get a meaning at all, the playfulness of our mind, the commentator just says it in a much more simple way. He says, Vishayi bhavatvat, because of looking upon all of these things, this is the commentator's explanation. Because of looking upon the body, mind, and senses as objects, and our author says, how idam dhyaha. Here, this dhyaha is the same, really, as what we had before. Dhyaha, actually, not the same word. The first dhihi is intellect. This dhyaha means concept or idea. And the word idam is our pronoun this. Idam dhyaha is the idea or concept of this. And what he means by that is when you refer, we'll go back to our pot. I talk about this as this pot. I use the word this specifically with regard to an object, and anything I use the word this is in that last line, idam dhyaha, the this concept. So this pot can be referred to as idam, with this idam dhyaha, with this concept. This pot, whenever I call something this, it is an object separate from me. This or that makes no difference. This means something near me. That means something far away from me. Means the same thing. Whenever I use a pronoun this, whatever I identify as this is different and separate from me. The pot is a this. My clothes are a this. This Anga Vastra, that's the name of this cloth, is different from me. Easy. This body Absolutely. This body, these senses, this prana, this mind, manas, this buddhi, intellect, whenever we use the word this, it's different from I. I wouldn't refer to this pot as an I. We use a pronoun I for who you are. We use a pronoun this for an object that's different from who you are. So just as I would never call this pot I, in the same way, it's confusion to refer to your body as I, or your senses, mind, etc. And not just to refer to your body as I, but the qualities of your body as I. The maleness or femaleness of your body belongs to your body, not to you. The sharpness or weakness of your senses belong to your senses and not to you. But look how our common languages, we say, I am male. I'm not male. Maleness happens to belong to my body. I am short-sighted. If I need to see far, I need glasses. I am short-sighted. Wait a minute. My eyes have a defect. I am not short-sighted. So the point is that whenever we use the word idam, the qualities of what I refer to, the qualities of the body, mind, senses, etc., don't belong to I. They belong to this. The maleness of this body belongs to the body, not me. The weakness of my eyes belong to my eyes, not me. The weakness of my prana belongs to prana, not I. You get it. The problems of my mind. This is crucial. The problems of your mind belong to your mind, not consciousness. Pardon the joke. If this pot is cracked, it's a crack pot. How does that have... But it is a this crack pot, not an I crack pot. I am not the crack pot. The pot is cracked. I'm making a bad joke. The point is, if there's a problem with your mind, we use that informally. Crackpot is someone with a defective mind. If there's a problem with the mind, the defect belongs to your mind and not to the consciousness, which is your true nature. This is our verse. Very nice. Very straightforward compared to verse 7. Let's proceed. Before chanting this verse, let me give it a proper introduction. Actually, let's chant the verse first. That's kind of our tradition, our convention. Then it's nice to stay with that. Sakshi sarvan vita prayan, sakshi sarvan vita prayan, aham naham kadachana. Aham naham kadachana, parinama paricheda, parinama paricheda, parita par upaplavat, parita par upaplavat. And this verse deals with a topic that we haven't seen in this text yet, so we need to explain it. Here's the objection. And the commentator very nicely spells out these objections. So the previous verse, the objection was, wait a minute, I experience myself as my body, mind, and senses. Here, the objector says, okay, I concede that since the body is mine, since body, mind, and senses are both mine and this, mamata and idam, therefore they're not me, the objector says. In the commentator's words. But now the objector, there's a new objection. I'm not the body, mind, and senses, but I am the ahankara. And now we need to define this term, and that's why we need to define that properly before we plunge into this verse. Ahankara, in English, we often translate as ego, but let's be very clear, not ego in the sense of pride. Ahankara can be used in the sense of pride, as it's used in Hindi, always in the sense of pride. But in Vedanta, we also use it as a highly technical term to describe a certain aspect of your experience, a certain aspect of your mind. And we call it ego, but a more meaningful translation might be self-concept or sense of being an individual. It's not just sense of individuality, sense of being who you are. In fact, let's stay with self-concept. Ego here in a sense of self-concept. When you meet someone for the first time and the person introduces himself, then you have to introduce yourself. How do you introduce yourself? Whatever you say by way of introduction is a self-concept, right? You say, I am, you might say, I am the husband or wife of so-and-so. You might say, I am a doctor or engineer, whatever happens to be your profession. You might say, you talk about yourself as a student of Vedanta, whatever it is. These all form part of your self-concept. And I'd like this idea to be a little bit more clear. And I have a brand new way of describing it. I've taught this so many times, but here's a different way of describing it. You've all watched these science fiction movies. And you've probably seen some kind of movie in which some human being's personality is implanted in a robot. Some kind of movie. So just imagine a movie in which a person's personality, a person, the essence of the person is implanted into a robot. What is it exactly that's implanted? That self-concept. That sense of being who you are with your history from childhood onwards is an important part of your self-concept, right? Your parents, where you were born, your early childhood experiences, the schooling you underwent, all college, everything, the jobs you've had, the people you know, the loved ones in your life, your likes and dislikes, preferences, etc. You know, you like this food, you don't like that food. All of these thousands and thousands of little factors combine into what we're calling a self-concept. And the technical term for it is ahankara. Literally, ahankara means that which the kara, the cause for aham. And here aham is it's a pronoun I, but here in a sense of I-ness, the cause for I-ness, the source of that self-concept. Speaking of movies, did any of you, I'm sure some of you watched those movies, I think a decade or so ago, the Matrix movies? I think there were a series of three movies. I watched them. Very interesting. If you did happen to watch those movies, you know that these people are projected into this matrix, into this computer-created reality. These people exist as human beings, but these as human beings, I think if I remember the plot right, they're kept in a state of coma, and their energy is harvested. If you watch the movie, you might remember that. The people are kept in a sense of coma, in a coma, and their energy is harvested. And while they're in a coma, their individuality is projected into this computer reality called the Matrix. Anyway, you get the point. That which is implanted in a robot, that which is projected into the computer reality called Matrix, that is the ahankara self-concept. And that self-concept, important thing here, that self-concept is a mental activity. Listen carefully. That feeling of being who you are with your history and, you know, your background and all, you know, what you like and what you don't like, all of those thousands of little factors that go in to your self-concept is all in your mind, is it not? In fact, even to feel like you are an individual person, that feeling of individuality is also ego, that ahankara, that feeling of individuality is in your mind, and we demonstrate this in Vedanta all the time by referring to deep meditation and deep sleep. Because in these two states, in deep dreamless sleep and in samadhi, you no longer have that feeling of being an individual person. It goes away. The feeling of being an individual person goes away in deep sleep and samadhi because they're mental events, mental constructs. It's part of your mind. This is the background we need for this verse. Now we can begin. In the second line, aham, there's our pronoun I. So here, the first part of this verse says, aham, remember the objection? The objection is, I'm not my body, mind, and senses. I am this self-concept, this ahankara. And here, our author, Lakshmi Dhara, says, aham, I am, go up to the first line, aham sakshi, I am the awareful witness. Aham sarva anvitaha, I am ever present, I am all pervasive. Aham prayan, and I'm going to talk more about each of these three words. Aham prayan, I am the most desirable. I am I'll have to come back to these words. Here's a point. I am this awareful witness who is all pervasive and desirable. And then it goes on, na aham kadachana. If you follow the Sanskrit, it looks very confusing. Aham, na aham. I am not I. Aham, na aham. Obviously, these two ahams have different meanings. The first aham is who you truly are. The second aham is a short form of ahankara. The author can get away with that because the author assumes you're smart enough to figure this out. And as I said, there are commentaries which help you. Aham na aham means I am not the ego. Kadachana, at any time, in any way whatsoever, I am not the ego. Na aham, na aham. I am not the ego. Aham sakshi. Aham sarvanvitaha. Aham prayan. Now we need to talk about those three words. A few of you may have figured out that these three words are actually code words for Satchidananda. So first of all, sakshi, awareful witness, is definitely a code word for chit, consciousness. When you say aham sakshi, I am the witness, awareful witness, observer, I am the consciousness by which all mental activities are known. Let me rephrase that. You, in essence, are the consciousness by which all experiences are known. And to refer to you as the conscious observer of all experience is what the word sakshi means. Witness in the sense of conscious observer, and conscious observer in particular of your mind's activities. So aham sakshi, representing chit in the expression Satchidananda. Aham sarva anvitaha. Sarva anvitaha, that which is present in everything. That which is present in everything, like clay is present in this pot, like threads are present in this cloth, sat, in the expression satchidananda, sat, pure existence or reality is present in everything. So sarva anvita, that which is present in everything, means sat in the expression satchidananda. And aham prayan. Prayan means that which is loved, that which is most loved. You might remember back in the second verse in this text, we had rather lengthy discussion about the word ananda. And the word ananda here is represented by the term prayan. And in that discussion, I just remind you of the main points, in the expression satchit ananda, ananda cannot be an experience of bliss, as you remember from that discussion, because satchit ananda is you, the experiencer, not something you experience. Bliss is an experience. Therefore, bliss is not you. The word ananda doesn't mean the experience of bliss. What does it mean? We talked about it at length back in verse 2. You can go back and listen to that class again, or just recall that what we seek in life, and I said back then, what my guru, Pujya Swamiji, calls the pleased self. Pleased self refers to contentment, refers to inner peace, refers to freedom from suffering, refers to a sense of completeness, fullness, even vastness. All of this refers to your true nature. All of this is conveyed by the word ananda. But instead of using the word ananda, he uses the word prayan. It means ananda. So here, instead of using sat, he uses sarvanvita. Instead of using chit, he uses sakshi. And instead of using ananda, he uses prayan. This connection is important to understand the verse. So he says, now to paraphrase the first half of the verse, our author says, aham, I am sat chit ananda. I am chit, consciousness, which is sat, identical to the fabric of existence. And I am ananda, full, complete, vast, limitless. We talk about the inner divinity. The so-called inner divinity is sat chit ananda. So aham, I am sat chit ananda, is how we describe Atma, after all, that inner divinity. I am Satchidananda, I am Atma, na aham. Aham, na aham, I am not the ego. Ego meaning what? That self-concept. If you write out your CV, your CV is your self-concept. Aham na aham. I am not the self-concept. I am not the person identified on your CV. Kadachana, in at any time, in any way whatsoever. Why? Once again, the second half of the verse gives the reasons. So we have these three words, satchidananda, and we have three reasons. We have a reason for each word. Our author is really highly structured. We said this is an advanced text, so you can see how he uses some sophisticated tools here, literary tools. So he says, we'll start in order. Aham sakshi. I am the awareful witness. I am the consciousness. Why? First, third line, parinama. Well, just to see the word. So he gives the three reasons. Parinama, reason one. Pariceda, reason two. and parita paihi, reason three, upaplavatvat, because these three are afflictions for ego. Upaplava is affliction. Ego is afflicted in these three ways. Consciousness is not afflicted. Ego is afflicted in these three ways. What are these three ways? So first of all, with regard to consciousness, aham, sakshi, sakshi, witness, representing chit, consciousness. He says here, parinama pariplavatvat, because ego is afflicted by parinama. Parinama means change or transformation. Let me leave that pariplavatvat part out. It'll just make it more confusing. So leaving it out, just to make this very simple, parinama, change, transformation, belongs to your self-concept, not to consciousness. So this is the argument for aham sakshi. I am consciousness. Consciousness is not subject to affliction. Ego is subject to affliction. Why? Parinama, because of its change. Changes, self-concept goes on changing. When you were a child, you had one self-concept. Your self-concept today is completely different. Think of how differently you look upon yourself today as opposed to when you saw yourself as a child. Those self-concepts are completely different. It's undergone a huge transformation over the decades of your life. Tell me, in all those decades, your self-concept has changed a lot. What about consciousness? The consciousness by which, watch this carefully, the consciousness by which your childhood self-concept was known and the consciousness by which your current self-concept is known, that consciousness is the same. I'll say that one more time. It's important. The consciousness by which your childhood self-concept was known and the consciousness by which your current self-concept is known, that consciousness is the same consciousness. It's undergone no change whatsoever in spite of the fact that your self-concept has undergone so much change. And when your self-concept undergoes change, it can really cause suffering. For example, if you're ill, especially if it's a chronic illness, then your self-concept is that of an ill person. I am ill. I am disabled. I am weak. It's a source of suffering. Consciousness isn't ill or disabled or weak. The self-concept is weak or disabled, suffering. Or maybe a better example, if you lose your job. So suppose you've been a successful business person, and then you lose your job. Previously, your self-concept was as a successful business person. Having lost your job, what happens to your self-concept? That's it. Self-concept undergoes change and is a source of suffering. But consciousness undergoes no change and is not subject to suffering. That's reason one. So he's giving you three reasons why you are Satchitananda. You are not your ego. You are not this self-concept. So reason one, self-concept undergoes change. Consciousness undergoes no change. Number two, paricheda. Paricheda is limitation, restriction, confinement. And it's a response to the second word, sarva anvitaha. Remember we said sarva anvita, all pervasive, ever present, is a word for sat. Remember, just as clay is present in this pot, as threads are present in this cloth, Sat is present, giving existence to everything in the universe. That Sat is Sarvanvataha, ever-present, all-pervasive. What about your ego? What about self-concept? Self-concept is not all-pervasive. Self-concept is associated with this one limited individual. If I were to be identified and say, I am Swami Tadatmananda, then my ego is identified with this limited individual, this limited person. What about consciousness? What about your true self? Satchidananda Atma, all pervasive, limitless. Even from the standpoint of consciousness, we've said several times how your consciousness has no boundary, has no edge, has no limit. Your own consciousness is limitless. We've discussed at great length in our Atma Bodha class, especially how there is but one consciousness that pervades the cosmos that is reflected or made manifest by your mind, by my mind, by every single mind. That true self, Atma, is all-pervasive. Ego, self-concept, is paricheda. It is highly limited, confined, restricted, but consciousness is not restricted in any way whatsoever. Consciousness is all-pervasive. Then the third reason, he says, paritapaihi. Paritapa means suffering. And that is a response to a doubt with regard to aham prayan, aham ananda. How can you say, I am ananda? The ego says, I'm not ananda, I'm subject to all kinds of suffering all the time. Who suffers? When you say, I'm in a bad mood, I'm suffering. Who suffers? When you say, I suffer, that statement is born of this ego, ahankara. Consciousness doesn't suffer, nor does consciousness think. Consciousness can't have the thought, I suffer. Consciousness is that by which you know you have the thought, I suffer. Hear that again. When you have the thought, I'm miserable, how do you know you have that thought? You know you have that thought, I'm miserable, because of consciousness. So look at what's present there. When you have that thought, I'm miserable, there are two things present. One is misery, pain, sadness, whatever it is, discomfort. Misery is present, but also present is that thought, I am miserable. One factor is misery. The other factor is, I am miserable. That second factor, I am miserable, is our self-concept, ego. It's all part of your mind. You know, it's they make a bad joke. It's all in your mind. In this case, it is. Your problems are all in your mind. Consciousness is that by which all these problems are known. And here's the most important factor here. Actually, we're going to see that in the next verse, but I'll just show it here. All these problems are in your mind, and all these problems seem to affect your consciousness, just like the orangeness of this cloth seems to affect a clear crystal. The fact is, this clear crystal is utterly unaffected by the orangeness of the cloth. In the same way, your consciousness is utterly unafflicted by all the problems of your mind. That's what he says, paritapa. This paritapa, afflictions belong to your ego, your self-concept. Afflictions do not belong to consciousness, your true nature. The next verse actually concludes this particular line of thought. Why don't we just go ahead and see that? No. Supteham, Yeah. Suptehamina drishyante. Suptehamina drishyante. Dukha dosha pravrittayaha. Dukha dosha pravrittayaha. Atastasyaiva samsaro. Atastasyaiva samsaro. Name samsartra sakshinaha. Name samsartra sakshinaha. Start in a second line. We were talking about problems in the prior verse. Here they are. Dukkha, dosha, pravrittayaha. Three categories. First category, dukkha. You know that word, pain, suffering. Dukkha is one category. Second, dosha. Now here, dosha in general means a defect, but here it's used as a technical term. And in Vedanta, it's often used as a particular technical term. The commentator makes it clear. Dosha is defect, but a particular kind of defect of your mind. And a particular defect of your mind is raga and dvesha. These likes and dislikes. This being drawn towards what you want and being repulsed from what you don't want. Attraction and aversion. Those are better translations. Dosha here means attraction and aversion, raga and dvesha. And the third one here is pravrittaya, is plural. Pravritti, engagement, action, activities. So here we have three categories of worldly life. What is present in the topic here is samsara. You see at the end of the third line. Samsara means worldly life, and in particular, samsara means that which you have to go through and continue to go through. It refers then to the suffering of worldly life. And the suffering, samsara, then refers to the suffering of worldly life, and it's characterized by these three words. Samsara is characterized by dukkha, suffering. No one can live without some suffering, dukkha. Also dosha, raga, dvesha, your attraction and aversion. And of course, attraction and aversion leads to pravritti, engagement, activities. And you know that when you are engaged in trying to get what you want, when you're engaged in trying to avoid what you don't want, those activities are sometimes successful and sometimes not successful, leading to happiness sometimes and sadness and suffering sometimes. This is worldly life. So our author has described worldly life with that expression, dukkha dosha pravrittayaha, worldly life characterized by suffering, characterized by attraction and aversion, and characterized by engagement in various activities. This threefold kind of worldly life, back up in the first line, na drishyante. These are not seen. These are absent. Absent when supte ahami. I'm just trying to see how so leaving out ahami, I'll come back to that. They are absent supte. Supti here means deep sleep, dreamless sleep. So supte, I'm trying to get to grammatically, it's a little bit strange. Already it's a little bit strange. He takes the pronoun aham and he puts it in a locative case, which technically is a violation of Sanskrit grammar, but it's done all the time. It's irregular, but it's done all the time. So my translation here, I think, is quite accurate in this case. Supte ahami na drish. supte in deep sleep. Funigo. Oh, that's my translation is better. Supte ahami. Aha, when, this is for our Sanskrit students, this is locative absolute, sati saptami. Ahami supte. When the, and this aham is not consciousness, not your true nature. This aham is the ahankara, the self-concept from the prior verse. Ahami supte. When that self-concept goes to sleep, I'm being very literal. Supte ahami. When that self-concept goes to sleep. When does it go to sleep? I gave two examples before. In deep sleep, you don't have that self-concept. In samadhi, deep meditation, you don't have that self-concept. So it says here, supte ahami, when your self-concept goes to sleep, when it goes away, when it's absent, then nadrishyante, these things are not seen, not experienced. What is not experienced? Dukkha, raga, dvesha, and pravritti activities. So these three things that characterize worldly life, suffering, attraction and aversion, and engagement in activities, these three, nadrishyante, are not experienced, they're absent, ahami supte, when the ego is absent. When the ego is absent, these three aspects of worldly life go away. Now, the point he's leading up to here is, who is it that undergoes samsara? Samsara is a suffering of worldly life. And he observes in the first half that when your ego is resolved in deep sleep or samadhi, you don't suffer, right? In fact, why is it that we all love sleep so much? Highly significant, by the way. You might think that sleep might be a state of void or emptiness or absolute non-existence, and as such it would be really frightening, but no one considers deep sleep as a state of void or emptiness. Deep sleep is something we all love because there's no suffering. The suffering of worldly life is absent in deep sleep. You are still present in deep sleep. We have had this discussion several times before, I think earlier in this text and extensively in our study of Atmabodha. In deep sleep, you are as conscious as you are right now. Only difference is right now, you're conscious of many things. In deep sleep, you're conscious of the absence of all experiences. Right now, you're conscious of experiencing many things. In deep sleep, you are conscious of experiencing nothing. So, the point, the first half says, in deep sleep, your experience of worldly suffering, samsara, comes to an end. And look at his conclusion. Ataha, in the third line, therefore, tasya eva samsaraha. Therefore, samsara, worldly suffering, tasya eva, belongs to your ego alone. It is your ego, your self-concept, that is subject to worldly suffering. It is your ego that is subject to dukkha, suffering, that is subject to raga, dvesha, aversion and attraction, and is subject to worldly engagement. It's your ego that is subject to this samsara, this worldly suffering, but not the true aham, not consciousness, not your true self. Third line, ataha, therefore, since your experience of worldly suffering goes away, when your ego goes away, he uses some logic to establish that if worldly suffering truly belong to consciousness. Watch this logic. If worldly suffering truly belong to your consciousness is present in deep sleep. So if worldly suffering belonged to consciousness, you would experience suffering in deep sleep. And you don't. This is his argument to prove that samsara, worldly suffering, belongs to your ego, your self-concept, and not to you, Satchidananda Atma. And that's what he says in the last line. He says, na me, samsara na me, worldly suffering does not belong to me, na me, doesn't belong to me, to your true nature as Satchidananda Atma. Why? Samsartra sakshinaha. Because your true nature as Satchidananda Atma is the sakshi, the witness of samsartra. Samsartra is the one who undergoes samsara, the one who suffers through worldly events. You are the witness of your ego. You are the conscious observer right now of the presence of your self-concept. And in deep sleep, you are the conscious observer of the absence of your self-concept. This is his argument to show that worldly suffering is absent in deep sleep. Worldly suffering belongs to your ego, which is absent in deep sleep. When your ego comes, when you wake up in the morning, you ever have that experience? You wake up, you go to sleep and enjoy this blissful sleep for several hours, and you wake up. Sometimes you wake up to a beautiful day. Sometimes you wake up to all your problems. That's what happens when that ego kicks in, as it were, when you wake up. If you had a lot of problems before you went to bed, while you're sleeping, you're free from all those problems. And when you wake up, you take on all those problems once again. Problems come and go as the self-concept, ego, ahankara, comes and goes. Based on that, all these problems do not belong to you as Satchidananda Atma, the consciousness who's present before you go to sleep, while you're asleep, and when you wake up. That unchanging consciousness doesn't possess samsara, worldly suffering. On the other hand, worldly suffering belongs not to you, consciousness. Worldly suffering belongs to that ego, that self-concept, ahankara. Okay, we'll conclude here. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet. Asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma hamritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om tat sat.